Chapter 6. The Holy Year, a Crucial Year, 1948-1950. Fatima's hour had struck once more at the approach of the Holy Year of 1950, just as in 1929, 1931. As we have shown, the rise of the increasingly menacing Red Peril, and in striking contrast, the wonderful rise of the Church, thanks to an intense Marian devotion and the increasing influence of the papacy, rendered the saving decisions easier. Everything was really moving Pius XII to become the Pope of Fatima in full. The gathering of an ecumenical council at that time would have been the ideal occasion to finally accomplish, with exactitude, all of Our Lady's requests. As we shall see, in February 1948 Pius XII was considering it. He made the decision and promptly ordered the preparatory work to begin. I towards the triumph of the Immaculate Heart of Mary? 1948-1949. The great movement of Marian fervour continues to grow. From day to day, the cult of the Immaculate Heart of Mary assumes a wonderful development, Pius XII observed with joy on September 19, 1948. Could anyone have imagined that during the years 1948-1949 alone, no less than 8 Marian congresses would have met? Or that in December 1948 the Marian congregations, pious and apostolic movements intended for the laity, would number 8 million members divided among more than 75,000 groups? It must be said that Pius XII encouraged their development. In his discourses, he also multiplied his references to the Immaculate Heart of Mary. Reminding the Polish bishops of the consecration they had just performed, he continued. The necessity of receiving one's strength and finding one's refuge in this Sacred Heart appears more pressing than ever today. For our Heavenly Mother does not only shine gently, like the morning star, but she is also this strong woman who, to avenge the rights of her Divine Son, has risen up several times in the Church, terrible as an army set in battle array. Nor did Pius XII lose any opportunity to recall the consecration of the human race to the Immaculate Heart of Mary made in 1942, at the time when all human resources and hopes seemed useless and incapable of settling a conflict of this gravity. He recalled this consecration once more on March 10 to the parish priests of Rome and Lenten preachers, and again on April 6. Yet again on May 1, in the encyclical Auspicia Quidam, the Pope insists even more. We desire that if opportune circumstances suggest it, this consecration, to the Immaculate Heart of Mary, be made in dioceses, as well as in every parish and in families, and we are confident that from this private and public consecration heavenly benefits and favors will result in abundance. Shortly afterwards, the city of Rome was solemnly consecrated to the Immaculate Heart of Mary. And while the definition of the dogma of the Assumption was being actively prepared, the white image of Our Lady of Fatima continued her missionary tour around the world. May 23-30, 1948, a shower of graces over the capital of Spain. The most extraordinary apotheosis ever recorded in the annals of Fatima, and certainly one of the most spectacular ones ever given the Most Holy Virgin, took place in Madrid in May 1948. So wrote Father de Fonseca. In 1948, Archbishop Ejo y Garay of Madrid was celebrating his 25th year as a bishop in the capital. Wishing to transform this solemnity into a homage to the Blessed Virgin, he decided to celebrate a Marian Congress during the first 9 days of May. He requested Bishop da Silva to lend him the statue venerated at the Cova da Iria, so that it might preside over the sessions. As the Bishop of Liria refused, Archbishop Ejo y Garay insisted on sending his request through diplomatic channels. At the request of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Lisbon, Bishop da Silva granted the favor requested. He even came to take part in the Marian Congress. The Bishop of Gurza and Cardinal Sir Gira also participated. On May 23, at the gates of Madrid, which then included 800,000 inhabitants, Our Lady of Fatima found 1.5 million believers to acclaim her. It was the greatest gathering in her honor ever seen. She was carried to the Plaza Major and then to the cathedral, where the faithful came running to her feet, day and night. In the following days, the missionary Virgin visited the suburbs of Madrid. Father Alonso writes that the people manifested an indefatigable fervor never seen in these quarters, and the graces of conversion and healing multiplied prodigiously. Father de Fonseca reports, the wife and daughter of the head of state came every day to visit Our Lady in the various churches where she was stationed. In the afternoon of the 26th, the image was transported to the residence of the head of state who, with all his family and all the civil and military personnel of his household, received her in the chapel of the palace which was richly decorated with flowers. The rosary was recited, followed by the singing of the Salve Regina. Then the chapel doors were opened, and the people came en masse to show their love for Our Lady. Our Lady then made special visits to the seminary and the university. In all the streets she passed through, Father Alonso recalls, the enthusiastic multitudes noisily acclaimed her. In spite of everything, the most remarkable demonstrations took place on the Plaza de la Armeria, transformed into a royal altar of the Virgin. The Mass of May 29, with the 10,000 sick people who attended it surrounded by an imposing multitude, with its series of miraculous healings, was a religious high point which it is impossible to describe. The whole thing was finally crowned by the Pontifical High Mass of Sunday, May 30. The Patriarch of Madrid officiated and the most eminent cardinals of Toledo and Lisbon assisted him. In special raised platforms were the Caudillo, his wife and daughter, and the entire government. There were also numerous prelates and other civil and military authorities. Cardinal Sir Gira's discourse was particularly eloquent. The image of Our Lady of Fatima, he declared, reminds me of the final merciful intervention of the Immaculate Heart of Mary. Her voice is the haunting cry of a mother, who sees unfathomable abysses of misery opening up before her poor, terrified children. It is an appeal, it is a hope, it is salvation in this apocalyptic hour. Fatima has become the hope of nations. What, precisely, is the message of Fatima? I believe that it can be summarized in these terms: it is the revelation of the Immaculate Heart of Mary to the present world. I repeat what I have often said, Fatima will be for the cult of the Immaculate Heart of Mary what Paray-e-Limonial was for the cult of the Heart of Jesus. Fatima, in a certain way, is the continuation, or better, the conclusion of Paray-e-Limonial. Fatima reunites these two hearts which God Himself united in the divine work of the redemption. All Madrid, writes Father Alonso, seemed to have gathered together to say its adieus to Our Lady. From the Paseo de Rosales, Auxiliary Bishop Morcelo received the image to carry it to Toledo. From there it returned to its Capilinha in the Cova da Iria. On his return to Lisbon, the Patriarch avowed that he had seen an extraordinary elan of faith and devotion in Spain. Spain has surpassed anything that can be imagined. What I saw at Madrid almost dazzled me. I saw the soul of Spanish Catholicism in its finest manifestation. He concluded, Our Lady willed to give proofs of love for Spain by miracles which were accomplished there. For his part, the Bishop of Madrid sent his thanks to Bishop da Silva for lending the statue from the Capilinha. I cannot find words expressive enough to describe to Your Excellency the marvel of the thrice-blessed image's passage across the streets and squares of Madrid during these 9 days, in which we had the happiness of possessing her. Days of heaven. A wave of the supernatural, dominating, triumphant, superior to all human expression. Only Mary can draw souls this way and win them for her divine Son. As soon as she entered my diocese, she never ceased conquering souls, gathering multitudes of hundreds of thousands of believers and even poor unbelievers, all bowed down before the image, acclaiming it, weeping, praying, singing pious canticles. Never, never was such a thing seen at Madrid. Throughout the country, people speak only about Our Lady of Fatima, her passage to Madrid, her numerous miracles, the innumerable conversions. I would give my 25 years of the apostolate here for these 9 days. During the whole time, the priests never left the confessional. The parish priests of the suburbs told me that over 40% of the people who asked to go to confession had not done so for 15, 20, or 30 years, etc. We have failed to point out that nowhere more than in Catholic Spain was the miracle of the doves more striking, more overwhelming for the countless crowds who were able to observe it. During the entire Congress, Our Lady was never seen in the streets or in the churches without this white honor guard, often very numerous. On this subject, the moving testimonies quoted by Barthas have to be read. Let us listen, for example, to Father José Luis Castillo, director of the Revue Reinado Social del Sagrado Corazón. May the Virgin pardon me, I wanted to find out for myself if the doves were free or attached, to tell the readers of Reinado Social. I went up the steps of the altar on Plaza de la Armeria, I approached them and tried to grab them. They defended themselves valiantly, not wanting to leave their queen, they pecked at me furiously. I succeeded in taking some of them and with all my strength I hurled them as far as I could. Let it be said in passing that Father Castillo is a giant and a veritable Hercules. They went no further than 2 yards, and brusquely returning, they went like arrows to Mary's throne, drawn by a powerful and mysterious magnet. At another moment, still possessed by the same idea, I thought there might be secret, invisible threads holding them down. As if they had guessed my thought, several took their flight at the same moment, circled the royal palace several times, and finally came to place themselves on the altar, some on her crown, others at Our Lady's feet. Here is one more, very touching example. Father Vermeer, O.M.I, who accompanied the statue, told us that a sick young girl expressed her regret that she could not leave her bed to admire the doves. When the procession passed before her room, a dove entered through the open window, remained some time on the wood of her bed facing her, and when the whole household had talked about its nice visit, it left to rejoin its companions. The following year, on May 4, 1949, Father Gorico had an audience with the Caudillo. He proposed to Franco the solemn consecration of Spain to the Immaculate Heart of Mary. Franco answered by extending his arms, like someone who ardently desires something, I desire it. But that must come from the hierarchy. The bishops were a long time in deciding, but nevertheless it did happen during the Marian year of 1954. Let us note that on October 26, 1949, during an official visit, Franco made a pilgrimage to Fatima. Photographs show him assisting at Mass, missal in hand, at the feet of the Virgin of the Capelin Ha. It cannot be denied that during those years, Spain experienced an incomparable Catholic Renaissance. On this point, Father Alonso's enthusiastic pages must be consulted. It was a period of authentic re-Christianization of Spain, he tells us. He went on to furnish solid proofs. The seminaries and religious scholasticates were filled and new ones had to be built. The popular missions multiplied and bore their fruits, assistance at the offices notably increased. Once again Spanish missionaries departed in great numbers for every point of the globe, especially South America. With reason, Father Alonso attributes this wonderful rise to the head of the Church, Pius XII. He attributes it also to her who was the soul and spiritual motor of this great movement of return to God, this little white virgin, a pilgrim and missionary who, in the years following 1948, went through each and every one of the regions of Spain. The Marvels of the World Tour. Our Lady not only passed through the highways of Spain, but those of the entire world. In effect, in April of 1948, Our Lady of Fatima visited successively, always with the same miraculous successes, the island of Madeira, Cape Verde, and Portuguese Guinea. In June, she visited the Azores, in July, São Tomé, then Angola. Everywhere in these Portuguese provinces, the miracle of the doves caused the crowds to marvel. All across the country, Barthas recalls, there was the same fidelity of the doves. In the Diocese of Luanda, the French Sisters of Saint Joseph direct several establishments, at Bale-Undu, Kakanda, and Sambo. Their monthly bulletin, O Service de la Moisson, informs us that everywhere the doves surrounded Our Lady's statue. At Bale-Undu, 7,000 Negroes awaited her arrival. At the moment the statue was placed on the litter, Our students released 5 white doves. They flew around a few moments and then went to gently place themselves at Our Lady's feet. They remained there during the procession, rosary, and benediction. The shower of flowers which fell upon them incessantly did not frighten them. At Kakonda, there was the inauguration of the Chapel of Our Lady of Fatima, a great feast for the community and its friends. There were very many Europeans, over 8,000 natives, 1,600 confirmations, 11,800 communions. One of our doves curled up at the feet of the statue, and on its own took a place in the plane carrying its heavenly queen. In all the missions and churches there were similar ceremonies, and always the doves. On September 30, Our Lady made her departure for Mozambique. A remarkable fact was observed. In all of Eastern Africa and in all predominantly Muslim countries, this gracious winged guard at the white statue's side was no longer seen. In the magnificent celebrations marking the passage of the world tour across South Africa, Rhodesia, Kenya, Tanganyika, Uganda, etc., it could be seen that the Muslims were more numerous and at times more fervent in their acclamations than the Catholics, but nowhere did anybody see the doves give the slightest sign of veneration to the Pilgrim Virgin. In Eritrea, in Sudan, in Egypt, and in Libya, there were no more doves next to Our Lady. The fact is highly symbolic. Although the missionary Virgin pours out her graces everywhere, the doves of peace which mysteriously accompany her in a Christian land can no longer follow their queen in a heretical or pagan country. Undoubtedly, this is to show us that in Christendom, and only in Christendom, where the true faith in the one God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, where the reign of Jesus Christ and His Divine Mother are officially recognized and proclaimed, can the Immaculate Mediatrix dispense the divine gift of peace to the nations as a true queen. This true peace cannot be experienced by any country as long as it remains under the yoke of error and discord of the prince of this world, who was a liar and a murderer from the beginning, John 8:44. What a pressing invitation, then, to work so that Christendom, the temporal kingdom of Jesus and Mary, finally extends to the very limits of a world at peace, and a period of peace will be granted to the world. The tours of Asia and Oceania. After returning to Portugal in July 1949, Our Lady's statue left the Lisbon airport once more on November 24. She arrived at Bombay on the 27th, and from there went to Goa by sea. After the visit to India, she was received triumphantly at Pakistan, returned to Bombay, visited Ceylon, and returned to the Kovida area by August 13 of the following year. Meanwhile, several statues bought by the Vicars Apostolic of Hanoi, Phat Diem, and Haiphong during a pilgrimage to Fatima went through Vietnam. In 1951, the tour went through Australia and Oceania. Shortly after, mentioning this journey of Our Lady of Fatima across the world, Pius XII was able to say, "At her passage in America and in Europe, in Africa and in India, in Indonesia and Australia, blessings poured down from heaven, marvels of grace were multiplied in such a way that we could hardly believe our eyes." As Our Lady of Fatima traveled as a missionary all over the world, did she not wish to give the Pope and bishops a striking proof of her all-powerful intercession in the conversion of souls and nations? Was it not already the pledge of her incomparable promise? Yes, she would convert Russia if her requests were obeyed. It was high time to do so. From the Kovida area, the humble and gentle missionary virgin left to dispense the torrents of her graces and mercies to distant lands. At the same time, atheist Bolshevism, led by Moscow, continued its implacable advance, bringing other ancient Christian countries under its Antichrist yoke and, wherever possible, undermining the Church's supernatural faith, hope and charity from within, by the contagion of its revolutionary ideology and its carnal messianism. To the rising dangers communism, progressivism, and neo-modernism. The liberation of 1944 and the installation of the Christian Democrats in power created within the Church, especially in France, a sort of ideological revolution whose deadly effects are still with us. At the seminaries and Catholic universities, in this period, Blondel, Bergson or even Sartre were often preferred to Saint Thomas Aquinas. This was the hour of triumph for the Mauritanes and Mauniers, who were unable to hide their admiration and sympathy for communism. It was the hour when modernism raised its head once more, with Fathers de Lubac or Danilou, while the poisonous writings of Teilhard de Chardin circulated surreptitiously, thanks to the complicity of many. It was the moment when Father Congar, already imbued with his false and chimerical ecumenism, was preparing his masterpiece, True and False Reform in the Church. This tiny intelligentsia, which at that time was as feeble numerically as it was restless, underhanded, and hypocritical, already formed a tumor in the very bosom of Christendom. As Pius XII said on June 2, 1948, referring to the Christian progressives, the Pope called them these numerous deluded souls, whose duplicity he condemned. He denounced the objectively pernicious character of their conduct, because while they continued calling themselves Christians, they fight at the same time as auxiliary troops in the ranks of those who deny God. Their treason was all the graver because in these years 1948 to 1950, Bolshevism continued its implacable advance, in the most alarming manner for the Church and Christendom. Is it necessary to recall, in a few words, the series of tragic successes it won on almost all fronts? From February 17 to 25, 1948, there was the famous Prague coup, the typical example of a communist coup d'état. It toppled the government of Czechoslovakia, throwing it into Moscow's domination for good. In Italy, the upcoming elections were awaited with anxiety, for the danger of a communist victory was real. On March 31, the Soviets took another step in the Cold War. They took the first measures which on June 25 were to result in the total blockade of Berlin. In Italy, on April 18, the communists won only 30% of the votes in the general elections. But that was already a lot, and this percentage continued to be disturbing. In Romania, with the active complicity of Patriarch Alexis of Moscow and the entire Orthodox national hierarchy, the communists decided on the liquidation, pure and simple, of the Greek Catholic Church, which numbered 1,600,000 faithful at the time. Towards the end of October 1948, they proceeded to arrest the Byzantine Catholic bishops, vicar generals, canons, and the majority of priests, about 600 in all. The government then proceeded to the confiscation of churches and convents of monks and religious, in spite of their resistance. On December 1, the communist government published the decree suppressing the Eastern Catholic Church. In France, a series of strikes broke out in October-November, which once again assumed the character of an uprising. In Hungary, Cardinal Mainz Zenti was arrested by the communists on December 26, and incarcerated at Budapest. On February 8, 1949, he was condemned to a life sentence in prison. In August 1949, the Catholic Church of Czechoslovakia underwent the same forcible suppression in favor of Orthodoxy as the Catholic Church of Ukraine and Romania. On September 21, Mao Zedong proclaimed the People's Republic of China while the world learned that the USSR now possessed the atomic bomb. In October came the creation of the German Democratic Republic. On December 16, Mao Zedong arrived at Moscow for the colossal celebrations of Stalin's 70th birthday, and also for important negotiations which a few months later resulted in the Sino-Soviet Treaty. In January 1950, the Soviet Union recognized the Vietnamese government of Ho Chi Minh. There was an even graver event, at least for the immediate future. On June 25, communist troops from North Korea crossed the 33rd parallel and invaded South Korea. It was the beginning of the Korean War. In other words, everywhere communism was advancing and nowhere was it being rolled back. Would it ever meet with an obstacle? 3. An extraordinary remedy, the convocation of an ecumenical council in the spirit of Fatima and Saint Pius X. The most important event of Pius XII's pontificate is practically unknown. In March 1948, the Pope decided to prepare a new ecumenical council. We can say in hindsight that if this council had met as planned in 1950 to 1951, it would have had a decisive mark on church history for the last half of the century. 12 years later, Vatican Council II did exactly the same thing, but certainly in a completely different sense. The preparatory work, 1948-1949. The initiative for the council had come from Cardinal Ruffini, Archbishop of Palermo. Later on he described how, 20 years ago, at the feet of Pius XII, I, the least of his priests, dared to invoke an ecumenical council. It seemed to me that this was urgently required by the circumstances, and that there were as many questions to handle as at the Council of Trent. The Venerable Pontiff did not refuse my proposition, he even made a note of it, as he was accustomed to do for important questions. I know that later on he spoke to a few prelates about it. This memorable audience took place on February 24, 1948. Cardinal Ruffini was one of the most remarkable cardinals in Holy Church, thanks to his grasp of theology and his perceptiveness on modern errors. He had surely spoken about the project beforehand with Cardinal Ottaviani, then the assessor of the Holy Office. On Thursday, March 4, 1948, during an audience with Monsignor Ottaviani, the Pope himself brought up this subject, recalling that Cardinal Ruffini had spoken to him about the necessity and appropriateness of convoking a council. Monsignor Ottaviani highlighted in turn the necessity of clarifying and defining certain points of doctrine before the mass of errors which were spreading on the philosophical, theological, moral, and social level. A council would also have proven extremely opportune for the desired proclamation of the dogma of the Assumption. In the course of this audience, the Pope decided to begin the preparatory work. Out of prudence, he desired that this work be done at the Holy Office and under the strictest secrecy. 10 days later, a limited commission of consultors was formed under the direction of Monsignor Ottaviani, and it went right to work. A preliminary catalogue of themes to be treated was drawn up, commissions were formed and the members chosen. After completing these three tasks, the preparatory commission was able to submit the results of its first 4 months of work to a plenary meeting of cardinals of the Holy Office on July 9, 1948. During an audience of July 22, Pius XII confirmed his desire to see the work continue, adding that above all they must be careful about choosing a good president and a good secretary for the Central Commission. On February 24, 1949, the Pope chose as president Archbishop Borgognini Duca, Apostolic Nuncio in Italy, and as secretary Father Pierre Charles, S.J., professor of dogmatic theology at the College of Louvain. The Central Commission was then created and its president, Archbishop Borgognini Duca, prepared a circular letter intended for a limited number of bishops, to consult them secretly about the future council. The spirit of the council. On May 13, 1949, must this happy coincidence be stressed, during the fourth meeting, the commission definitively approved the letter which had to be sent to the bishops, whose list was reviewed once more and approved. Here is this document, which is enough to clearly indicate the spirit of the future council, the spirit of Pius IX, Vatican I and Saint Pius X. The quagmire of dangerous errors, as well as the grave perils with which the Church and society are still threatened, which led to the convocation of the solemn Vatican Council 80 years ago, far from going away and diminishing, seem on the contrary to be growing worse. As the impediments which had forced Pius IX to suspend the council now seem for the most part to have been removed, His Holiness Pope Pius XII, now happily reigning, has judged it extremely opportune and perfectly worthy of his charge and supreme pastoral solicitude to resume this council and lead it to its conclusion at the desired time. The soul and the charity of His Holiness, the mandate entrusted to him by Christ to protect and feed the sheep, as well as the other sheep which must be led to the one fold and one shepherd, compel him to act in such a way that all may be able to enjoy the superabundant fruits of the redemption together and in security. Moreover, among the questions of faith and morals which had been prepared for the first Vatican Council, those which were defined were few, although grave. Many, on the other hand, were put off. Among these latter, some are outmoded. Others were provided for by decrees of the Holy See later on, but there are some which are still awaiting their solution. To these are added new and very grave questions which today arise everywhere, to oppose themselves to Christ, His doctrine, and His Church. Please say simply, therefore, in a few very clear sentences, before the Lord and under the strictest secrecy of the Holy Office, what you judge is particularly worthy of now being submitted to the future council and, if need be, of being defined by it, amongst doctrinal or practical questions, moral, juridical or social questions, those concerning the discipline of the clergy and the Christian people, or the extension of God's kingdom by the missions. This, Eminence, is what I had to communicate to you at the request of His Holiness. Please give your response, which is awaited as early as possible. Deign to accept. There is no need to quote excerpts of the preconciliar work. This preliminary letter is sufficiently explicit. Father Caprell deplores it, observing, the general proceeding of the work and the tone of the documents, which were to have been prepared or actually were prepared, appear to be dominated above all by the preoccupation of warning against errors and condemning deviations. In other words, it would have been a traditional council, in the spirit of the Council of Trent and Vatican I, whose work it was intended to complete. It would have been a dogmatic council, and by that very fact infallible. It would have swept the modernist and progressivist heresies out of the Church for good, and contributed powerfully to the recovery of the West by firm condemnations of Marxist doctrines and praxis, and all collaboration with it. In short, an ecumenical council in 1950 under Pius XII would unquestionably have been a council of counter-reform and counter-revolution. In 1964, even before Pius XII's project was known to the public, our father, the Abbé de Nance, wrote concerning the evolution of Vatican Council II. It was not unavoidable. The same fathers could have been convoked in council by Pope Pius XII, as I had dreamed back then, to respond to the urgent needs of Christendom. The Pope would have placed on their agenda the condemnation of collectivism and laicism, the proclamation of the message of Fatima and the consecration of the world to the Immaculate Heart of Mary, the analysis of progressivism and its condemnation, the placing of Teilhard and a few others on the index. Some great doctor would have reminded the fathers at the beginning that they were neither diviners nor prophets, but a magisterium in the service of a tradition, and pastors responsible for their sheep. They would have had to inform themselves and then answer, in conscience, some precise questions according to their faith and not according to their opinion. What do you think would have happened? 50 or so progressives would have pleaded for the novelties, for liberty, for adaptation to the world. 100 excellent theologians would have luminously recalled the Church's faith, and shown her salutary opposition to the errors ravaging Christendom and preparing her to capitulate before satanic communism. Then all the saving decrees would have received the lively adherence of an immense majority. Unanimous with the Pope, they would have pointed the way to the mental and moral recovery of humanity. The persecuted Church would have been supported in its faith, and Christendom would have received graces, light and strength for its spiritual recovery and the necessary conversion of lukewarm souls. The most detailed analysis of the declarations and decisions of Pope Pius XII, in these decisive years from 1948 to 1951, confirms this estimate on every point. It is sufficient to read the pontifical documents of Pope Pius XII during this period to discover what would have been the great orientations of the Council being prepared according to his directives. Father Caprell confirms this, informing us that it appears that Pius XII took into account the material elaborated, and used it in several of his documents, especially in the encyclical Humani Generis, and in certain of his discourses having a major doctrinal importance. The Pope was increasingly alarmed by the quagmire of dangerous errors and by the grave perils with which the Church and society were threatened, and since 1947 had in part begun to make a series of courageous decisions to remedy the situation. He engaged the Church in a reaction, in a triple effort which could have borne fruit and become extremely effective in the framework of the projected ecumenical council. At issue was the defense of the Catholic faith in the very spirit of Saint Pius X, and the combat for the safeguarding of Christendom in the light of Fatima. At the same time, the Pope wanted to promote, especially on the occasion of the Holy Year, a true reform of morals among the people and the clergy, for the salvation of a greater number of souls. How can we fail to see that these three major concerns of Pius XII, attested by so many documents from the years 1949 to 1950, which also would have been the documents of the Council, corresponded precisely to the three parts of the Secret of Fatima? The battle for the faith, in the spirit of Saint Pius X. Pius XII had an admiration and unlimited love for his holy predecessor. If we read all the discourses for canonizations and beatifications, we will find that none of them was warmer, more enthusiastic than the one he pronounced in honor of the Holy Pontiff. It is important to stress that, while he asked the Holy Office to work on preparations for the future council, he decided to speed up the canonization of Saint Pius X. In contrast with the mortal hatred which the ringleaders of neo-modernism and progressivism bore the Holy Pope, Pius XII wished by his canonization to impose his example and his doctrine on the entire Church. Let us quote here a few excerpts from the important beatification discourse. It expresses the constant thinking of Pius XII. Reading these lines, we discover not only the figure of the Holy Pontiff, but also the thinking and ideal of his successor. Along with some moving recollections, there is also this affirmation of the highest importance: Pius X is, par excellence, the Pope of the 20th century, and his providential mission in the service of the Church extends well beyond the limits of his pontificate. He dominates his century. He also would have dominated an ecumenical council called by Pius XII. This Pope of the 20th century, in the formidable hurricane stirred up by the deniers and enemies of Christ, from the beginning was able to show consummate experience in governing the bark of Peter. Pius XII then evokes the Good Shepherd, always indifferent to himself, simple from his childhood days until the hour when Providence incited the mind and heart of his peers to place the shepherd's staff, which had fallen from the weakened hands of the great, aging Leo XIII, into his own fatherly firm hands. At that time the world needed precisely such hands. But once he pronounced his fiat, this humble man, who had died to earthly things and aspired with all his being to the things of heaven, demonstrated the indomitable firmness of his spirit, the manly vigor, the grandeur of courage which are the prerogatives of the heroes of sanctity. From his first encyclical, which was like a luminous flame rising up to enlighten minds and hearts. Have not you too experienced this ardour, dear children who lived through these days and heard from his lips the exact diagnosis of the errors of his epoch, and at the same time the means and remedies needed to heal it? What clarity of thought! What force of persuasion! It was indeed the knowledge and the wisdom of an inspired prophet, the intrepid frankness of a John the Baptist and a Paul of Tarsus, it was the paternal tenderness of the vicar and representative of Christ watching over all necessities, solicitous for all the interests, all the miseries of his children. Pius XII was not afraid to bring up the underhanded criticisms expressed by the adversaries of the Holy Pope. But it was to refute them immediately, and with what vigor! Is it true, as some have said or insinuated, that in the Blessed Pontiff's character force often prevailed over prudence? Such was perhaps the opinion of adversaries, the majority of whom were also enemies of the Church. To the extent, however, that it was shared by others, who still remained admirers of Pius X's apostolic zeal, this estimation is shown to be contradicted by the facts. Now that the most thorough examination has gone over all the acts and vicissitudes of his pontificate, now that the results of these events are known, no hesitation, no reservation is possible any longer. It must be recognized that even in the most difficult and hardest periods, the periods heaviest with responsibilities, Pius X, assisted by his most faithful Secretary of State, the great figure of Cardinal Mary del Val, demonstrated this enlightened prudence which is never lacking to the saints, even when in its applications it finds itself in painful but inevitable contrast with the misleading dictates of human and purely worldly prudence. With his eagle eye, which was more perceptive and sure-sighted than the short-sighted views of myopic reasoners, he saw the world such as it was, he saw with the eyes of a holy pastor what his duty was in the midst of a de-Christianized society, a Christendom infected or at least threatened by the errors of the time and the perversion of the century. Illuminated by the clarity of eternal truth, guided by a delicate, lucid conscience of rigid uprightness, he often had intuitions and decisions to make concerning his present duty that disturbed those who were not endowed with similar lights. By nature, no one was more gentle, more lovable than he, no one more fatherly. But when the voice of his conscience as shepherd spoke, nothing counted any more except the sense of duty. The latter imposed silence on all the considerations of human weakness, it put an end to all hesitations and decreed the most energetic measures, as painful as they were to his heart. The humble country priest, as he sometimes liked to call himself, and to call him that does not lessen his stature, knew how to stand up like a giant, in all the majesty of his sovereign authority. His non possumus made the powerful ones of the earth tremble and at times retreat, reassuring the hesitant at the same time and galvanizing the timid. To this unshakable strength of his character and conduct manifested from the first days of his pontificate must be attributed the stupor, then aversion of those who wished to make him the sign of contradiction, thus revealing the darkness of their souls. Defender of the faith, herald of eternal truth, guardian of the holiest traditions, Pius X revealed a very keen sense of the needs, the aspirations, and energies of his times. This was the example which Pius XII desired and would have liked to follow. Pius XII goes on to praise his predecessor as the incomparable promoter of the sacred and profane sciences, and the true author of the new code of canon law. Finally, let us quote the conclusion of the discourse, which is directly related to our purpose. What did the name of Pius X signify, we asked ourselves at the beginning. Now we see it clearly. Through his person and through his work, God wanted to prepare the Church for the new and difficult duties which an agitated future reserved for it. In an opportune way, he wanted to prepare a Church united in doctrine, solid in discipline, efficient in its pastors, a generous lay people, a people well instructed, a youth sanctified from its first years, a vigilant conscience regarding the problems of social life. If today the Church of God, far from retreating before the forces destructive of spiritual values, suffers and fights, and through the divine power progresses and redeems souls, this is due to the far-sighted action and holiness of Pius X. It is manifest today that his entire pontificate was supernaturally oriented according to a design of love and redemption, to dispose our spirits to face our own struggles and assure our victories and those of generations to come. Yes, everything leads us to think that a council called in 1950 would have worked according to the teachings and spirit of Saint Pius X. Besides, many statements and decisions of Pius XII were already going in this sense. For example, there was the warning against ecumenism, recalling the absolute prohibition of all communicatio in sacri. There was also the pressing invitation given the parish priests of Rome and Lenten preachers on March 23, 1949, to continue preaching the doctrine of hell without any attenuation, such as Christ revealed it, and there is no circumstance of time which can diminish the rigor of this obligation. There was the long exhortation Menti Nostri to the clergy of the world, and above all the encyclical Humani Generis of August 12, 1950. Our father, the Abbé de Nance, believes that this encyclical is the most recent in date of the documents of the Church's infallible magisterium, along with the definition of the dogma of the Assumption 3 months later, on November 1. If the condemnations and warnings found in Humani Generis against all the errors of neo-modernism and progressivism had been solemnly expressed by an ecumenical council, as had been planned, their effectiveness would have been much greater, and no theologian could have remained in the Church without completely submitting to them. The battle for Christendom in the light of Fatima. If we go through the pontifical documents of 1949 to 1950, we can see that instead of the chimeras of Ostpolitik, the Pope's attitude towards Bolshevik Russia now corresponded perfectly to Our Lady of Fatima's demands. On almost every page, we find a mention of the enemies of Christ and the Church, and the faithful undergoing their persecutions. Let us retain only the most significant text, The apostolic exhortation to the bishops, authorizing a votive mass in reparation for the crimes caused by the hatred of God. Does not this letter of February 11, 1949 already essentially correspond to the solemn and public act of reparation requested by Our Lady of Fatima since 1929? The struggle between the good and the wicked, whose conduct and actions taken together still constitute the history of the human race, has rarely and perhaps never been as violent as in our time. If, from this citadel of the Vatican, we look at the earth in every direction, we have reason to be filled with admiration and joy, seeing the resplendent virtues of the compact groups of good men who are reminiscent of the earliest ages of Christianity, especially through the merit of their courage and the glory of martyrdom, but on the other hand we are overwhelmed with sadness and anguish, seeing that the wickedness of perverse men has reached a degree of impiety that is unbelievable and absolutely unknown in other times. We are horrified to speak of this disgrace, venerable brethren, but by reason of the duties of our apostolic office, we cannot be silent. The haughty and scornful disdain for the things of God, which was the first crime of man, who refused to obey the order from on high, is the seditious source of all evils, and in our own epoch it is spreading and being unchained like a virulent evil over almost all the earth, but in certain regions especially, because of the conspiracy raised up against the Lord and against His Christ, PS 2:2, it engenders absolutely innumerable evils. We are referring to atheism, or more exactly, the hatred of God. In their sovereign impudence, those who hate the name of God take advantage of all kinds of helps and methods. Books, memoirs, journals, radio programs, meetings, rallies, and private conversations, sciences and the arts, they use everything to spread hatred for holy things. There came out of the pit smoke, like that of a great furnace, and the air was darkened by the smoke from the pit. APOC 9:2, we believe, venerable brethren, that such events are not taking place without the perfidious intervention of the infernal enemy, whose characteristic is to hate God and harm mankind. Let there be nothing more urgent, therefore, for you, your priests and the faithful entrusted to your care than to stir up a rivalry of zeal to defend this name of God which the angelic powers venerate while trembling, raising the standard of Saint Michael the Archangel and repeating the exclamation, "Who is like unto God?" Oppose those who insult the Supreme Majesty with the most energetic determination to affirm, to love, and to preach the name of God. If therefore atheism and the hatred of God constitute a monstrous sin which besmirches our century, and justly makes it fear baleful chastisements, the blood of Christ contained in the chalice of the new covenant is a purifying bath in which we can efface this execrable crime, and after having asked for pardon for the guilty, we can dispel the consequences of this crime and prepare a magnificent triumph for the Church. While we meditate on these thoughts, it has seemed opportune to us that on Passion Sunday of this year, you and all priests be authorized and even exhorted to celebrate a second Mass, which will be the votive Mass for the remission of sins. On February 14, 1949, Pius XII convocated an extraordinary consistory to solemnly protest against the condemnation of Cardinal Mindszenty on February 9. On February 20, Passion Sunday, during the Mass celebrated before St. Peter's Basilica, the Pope developed the same themes. Can the Pope be silent when in a nation, churches united to Rome, the center of Christendom, are torn away from it by violence or by fraud, when all the Greek Catholic bishops are imprisoned because they refuse to apostatize from their faith, when priests and faithful are persecuted and arrested because they do not consent to being separated from their true mother, the Church? Can the Pope be silent when, etc.? In Czechoslovakia, the communist government had founded a Catholic action in the pay of the regime. On June 20, 1949, the Holy Office, in the name of the Sovereign Pontiff, reproves and condemns this movement fraudulently called Catholic Action, and at the same time declares to be schismatics and apostates all ecclesiastics and lay people who knowingly adhere to it now or in the future. They have incurred and will incur ipso facto excommunication reserved to the Apostolic See. On June 13, 1949, titles of this nature could be read in one of the journals, Rome Against Moscow. Under pain of excommunication, Catholics are forbidden to aid the Communist Party. L.E. Figaro. In fact, there had been a decree of the Holy Office approved by the Pope on June 30, and promulgated on July 1. Here is its content. 1. Communism is materialistic and anti-Christian, although the communist leaders sometimes declare in words that they do not attack religion, they show this in fact by their doctrine and by their acts, which are hostile to God, to the true religion and to the Church of Christ. Therefore it is forbidden to register as a member of a communist party or favor it in any way. 2. Reviews, journals or flyers supporting the doctrine or action of the communists are condemned by the law itself, cf. Canon 1399. Thus it is forbidden to publish them, spread them, read them, or write for them. 3. The faithful who knowingly and freely violate these prohibitions cannot be admitted to the sacraments. 4. The faithful who profess the materialistic and anti-Christian doctrine of the communists incur by the law itself, as apostates from the Catholic faith, excommunication specially reserved to the Holy See. In this atmosphere, not only of Cold War but an open struggle to the death between the Vatican and Moscow, between the Church and the synagogue of Satan, between light and darkness, the preparations for the Council continued, while the Holy Year was opened. The program of the Holy Year, the true reform of morals. Better than preceding ones and incomparably more so than following ones, this Holy Year really influenced the life of the Church. It is necessary to read the Bull Jubileum Maximum of May 26, 1949 and the radio message to the world of December 23, which set out the program of the Holy Year and make clear its spirit. It is the spirit of the message of Fatima. Indeed, Pius XII remarked as much to the Portuguese pilgrims on several occasions, the heavenly message of Our Lady of Fatima which was announced over there, but with the intention of being passed on to the world, is almost the anticipated message of an unending holy year. This program would also have found its full realization within the framework of an ecumenical council. At the same period, by a decree of December 21, 1949, Bishop da Silva appointed the Diocesan Tribunal to conduct the informative process on the heroic virtues of Jacinta and Francisco. This decision opened the canonical process of the Little Seers of Fatima. We may believe that it was not made without the Holy Father being informed, and giving at least his tacit consent. The Church's great hope. The Jubilee year of 1950 unquestionably marked the high point of Pius XII's pontificate. Perhaps never before had the papacy enjoyed such prestige, such moral authority, such universal influence. In 1925, the Holy Year pilgrimages had led 800,000 of the faithful to Rome, the highest number of pilgrims ever reached. In this year, 1950, over 3 million came to venerate the tomb of the Prince of the Apostles. Every week, on Wednesday and Saturday, often drew 30,000 to 40,000 faithful to St. Peter's Basilica. A happy omen, Our Lady of Fatima at Moscow. In January 1950, a Fatima Pilgrim Virgin statue blessed at the Kovoda Iria on October 13, 1947, was introduced into Russia by Father Brassard, an American Assumptionist and chaplain of the Diplomatic Corps. The statue found its place of rest in the city of Moscow, in an oratory from which the Kremlin's towers were visible at a distance. At night, the two red stars shining before the communist fortress were like the lamps of an icon, one on each side of the statue, silently honoring the Queen of Russia. Was this presence of the Immaculate Virgin in the center of Moscow the sign heralding her triumph through the conversion of Russia? Everything depended on the salutary decisions made by the Pope during this holy year. To make these decisions, he would have to overcome a second opposition, the secret, hypocritical, underhanded but implacable opposition from the supporters of neo-modernism and progressivism, who were against both Fatima and the great project of the Ecumenical Council. 4 Shady Maneuvers. An offensive against Fatima. The progressive intelligentsia bitterly deplored the increasing credence the Pope seemed to give the apparitions and message of Fatima. In the critical studies of Father Danes, they had found an effective propaganda instrument. In 1948, Monsignor Jurnet, the future cardinal and friend of Monsignor Montini, used these studies to write an extremely violent article against Fatima, an article studded with gross errors and utterly lacking any value. Meanwhile, a condensed version of Danny's theses was circulating among the bishops. Before long, Father de Fonseca reports, the most bewildering rumors were circulating in Germany, Belgium, and elsewhere. Rome's attitude towards Fatima, it was said, had substantially changed. A short period of consideration and enthusiasm was followed by coolness, disinterest, disillusionment. Somebody even dared to affirm that His Holiness had declared to a highly placed member of the hierarchy that Fatima was the greatest disillusionment of his pontificate, and that naturally he didn't want to hear any more talk about it. In France, during a great meeting of the clergy, this news was given by a conference speaker. The sovereign pontiff, or perhaps the superior general of the Jesuits, appointed a commission presided over by Father Danys, S.J., a distinguished professor at the Faculty of Louvain, to study the case of Fatima. The commission, it was said, pronounced unanimously against it. In Germany, similar rumors were being spread among the clergy. All these lies seemed to be perfectly orchestrated. Where were they coming from? It is difficult to say. All the same, it is astonishing that in such a context Father Danys was promoted at Rome. Indeed, it was precisely in 1949 that he was appointed professor at the Gregorian University. At the very least, he must have had powerful protectors back then. Was Monsignor Montini, who later on made Danys one of his confidants, protecting him already? In any case, Father Janssens, who had been elected Superior General of the Jesuits on September 15, 1946, was also Belgian. He was a former student, professor, and rector of the Theological College of Louvain, and greatly esteemed Father Danys. We have good reasons to believe that he covered for Danys in his offensive against Fatima. Underhanded opposition to the Ecumenical Council. The preparatory work, undertaken with such enthusiasm and effectiveness under Monsignor Ottaviani's direction, continued. However, unforeseen difficulties came up. Apparently Father Charles, secretary of the Central Commission and a Jesuit from the very liberal University of Louvain, had skillfully contributed to bringing the work to an impasse. Father Capril writes. Third period of the preparation, July 1949 to January 1951. During this period of about a year and a half, the Central Commission met very rarely. The Secretary General had returned to Louvain, and he came to Rome only two or three times. Now that is really astonishing. Did not the preparations for an ecumenical council have the most absolute priority over every other activity? True, during this time at the Holy Office, the subcommissions continued to accomplish very important, even abundant work, each in its own domain. The theological and biblical subcommissions were each preparing a vast doctrinal schema. The subcommission for moral and social questions was preparing a schema very theological in nature and clearly theocentric, while the Subcommission for Discipline and Liturgy examined, among other things, projects for reform of the Mass and Breviary. All this was certainly excellent. Unfortunately, Father Charles and his friends in Rome and Louvain had other ideas, which they tried to make prevail to avoid the worst in their eyes, the full success of a dogmatic council where on all controversial points Catholic truth would be infallibly defined and modern errors vigorously condemned, while at the same time in the biblical, pastoral, and liturgical domains, the Church would show a wise openness to the progress of exegetical and historical sciences, and prudent readiness to promote useful reforms, but in the strict Roman discipline. This type of council was not on the agenda of the few liberals or liberal minds called to participate in the work. Father Capril continues. This progress in the preparation caused differences and increasing difficulties to appear. Two tendencies manifested themselves in the Central Commission, holding different opinions on the organization and the very basis of the council. V. The great turning point of the Holy Year. Pius XII and the Council. Nothing was lost, however, at the dawn of the year 1950. On the contrary, there was every reason to hope that, concerning the council, the Pope would take the position of the men of doctrine and tradition. The Holy Office was still all-powerful, and it would have sufficed if Pius XII, informed by some perceptive adviser, had quashed the tortuous plans of the handful of opponents. Then the council would be able to meet and rapidly succeed. The hierarchy was more ready than ever for it, since the death of Saint Pius X. Pius XII and Fatima. As for the insidious campaign launched against Fatima, the Pope had firmly reacted in the beginning of 1950. I know with complete and immediate certainty, Father de Fonseca reports, that when His Holiness was asked if the phrase attributed to him about the greatest disillusionment of my pontificate had some foundation, he exclaimed, "The things people make up." And he immediately authorized a categorical denial, an authorization he later gave on several occasions. This authorization was given in the most solemn manner, notably to Father Suarez, Master General of the Dominicans, who declared publicly at Fatima, on October 12, 1952. If someone tells you that the Sovereign Pontiff is disappointed by Fatima, know that it is not true. Not too long ago, during the Holy Year of 1950, while visiting our houses of Central Europe, I heard in several places that the Pope said that confidentially. On my return, I requested a special audience, and I told the Holy Father what I had heard. To that the Holy Father responded, "I never said or thought such a thing. What new proofs do you want the Pope to give you of his love for Fatima? Can I tell my religious that? Tell them that the Pope's thinking is contained in the message of Fatima. Tell your religious to continue working with the greatest enthusiasm promoting the cult of Our Lady of the Rosary of Fatima." Fortified by this encouragement, Father Suarez immediately decided to install Dominicans at Fatima. On October 12, 1951, he blessed the cornerstone of the convent. On October 12, 1952, he was at the Cova de Iria again for the inauguration of the new house, intended to become the novitiate and house of studies for the Dominican province of Portugal. He declared, "We will remain at Fatima to propagate the rosary as long as Our Lady wants. Dominicans will come here from everywhere, and as they leave, they will bring devotion to Our Lady of Fatima to the whole world." Certainly, in the beginning of this holy year, Pius XII was not sparing in his encouragement for Fatima apostles, quite the contrary. The Blue Army of Monsignor Colgan already numbered 1 million members, and it had just launched the publication of Soul, its review promoting Fatima. On May 8, Monsignor Colgan was received in a private audience by Pius XII. The Pope, who had on his table the first issues of the magazine, declared to the founder of the Blue Army, "As the world's leader against communism, I gladly give my blessing to you and all the members of the Blue Army. Now, the time for doubting Fatima has passed. The hour for action has arrived." Pius XII and the New Theology. The Pope continued to invite the faithful insistently to amend their lives, to pray and make atonement for the sins of the world, sins undoubtedly graver, he affirmed, than in any century past. In this way the faithful could obtain from the divine mercy the great return of humanity, which has rebelled against the laws of God and the Church. At the same time, the Pope continued the struggle against the errors of the time. On May 13, he had the Biblical Commission publish an instruction on the teaching of Holy Scripture in seminaries and religious institutes, which was directly in line with finally, the proscriptions of Pius XII no doubt were too discreet, too benign. They were enough to drive the likes of Teilhard, de Lubac, Danilo, Rahner, Chenu, and Congar underground in view of their cowardice, and preserve the faithful from the contagion of their neo-modernism. They ducked out of sight, hypocritically. The neo-modernists even tried to convince people that they were not being referred to in the encyclical. Pope Pius XII, proclaiming the infallible definition of the dogma of the Assumption of the Most Holy Virgin. On August 14, El Osservatore Romano announced the proclamation of the dogma of the Assumption of the Most Holy Virgin, which took place on November 1, 1950. On September 3, Pius XII ordered publication of the decree on Pope Pius X's heroic virtues. In the struggle, again on September 23, on October 20, waiting for great decisions. Nevertheless, on the subject of Our Lady of Fatima's precise requests, in this holy year the Pope still seemed hesitant about committing himself any further. To be sure, a few mentions of Fatima and its message can be found in the Pontifical Discourses of 1950. But they are simple allusions, not very rich in content. It is hard to dispel the idea that the Jesuit plot against Fatima, for something of the kind did exist, made an impression on the Pope all the same, at least in this sense, he knew from now on that decisions too openly favorable to Fatima would arouse resistance, fierce opposition, and that, even in his immediate entourage, several people would judge these initiatives unfavorably. Pius XII remained indecisive. Now it seems that in this decisive hour, when everything suddenly hung in the balance, while awaiting the great decisions the sovereign pontiff was to make regarding both the council and Fatima, and these two holy causes were intimately linked with each other, it seems that heaven really did intervene to enlighten the Pope, to encourage the Church's supreme pastor to act forcefully and with prudence, so as to correspond fully to the great designs of mercy of the holy hearts of Jesus and Mary. Sister Lucy had very much wished for this intervention from heaven, and implored it on many occasions. We remember that in 1936, she said to God in her prayer, "But my God, the Holy Father will not believe me unless you yourself move him with a special inspiration." In 1940, she wrote concerning the consecration of Russia by the Pope, "Our good Lord could through some prodigy show, the Holy Father, clearly that it is he who asks it, but he takes this opportunity to punish the world with his justice for so many crimes, and to prepare it for a more complete return to him." In the beginning of 1942, our Lord had informed his messenger that he had given the Holy Father the inspiration to fulfill his requests, but that the Holy Father still hesitated. In the autumn of 1950, the hour of mercy had come once more. The miracle of Fatima at the Vatican, October 30 to November 8, 1950. On October 29, the statue of the Pilgrim Virgin of Fatima, which had just visited several nations of Asia, arrived at Rome. On the following morning, October 30, 35 cardinals and over 450 bishops had met in consistory around the sovereign pontiff, who for the first time officially informed them of his intention of defining the dogma of the Assumption very soon. At the end of his allocution, he consulted the successors of the apostles one last time, "Is it therefore pleasing to you, venerable brethren, that we proclaim and solemnly define as a dogma revealed by God, the bodily Assumption of the Blessed Virgin Mary into heaven?" After receiving their unanimous assent, the Pope gave thanks. On the very same day, Monday, October 30, after this solemn decision, while the Madonna of Fatima had stopped for 3 days in the Church of Casalito, right behind the Vatican Gardens on land belonging to the Holy See, on the anniversary of the consecration of the world to the Immaculate Heart of Mary 8 years earlier, it was given the Holy Father to contemplate the same extraordinary spectacle that 70,000 pilgrims had seen at the Cova d'Iria, on October 13, 1917. Here is the account written shortly afterwards by Pius XII himself. "It was October 30, 1950, 2 days before the day of the solemn definition of the Most Holy Virgin Mary's Assumption into heaven, the day which the entire Catholic world was awaiting impatiently. On this 30th of October, around 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I took my usual walk in the Vatican Gardens, reading and studying various official papers as usual. I went up the Esplanade of Our Lady of Lourdes to the top of the hill, in the passage on the right near the walls. At a certain moment, having lifted my eyes above the papers I had in my hand, I was struck by a phenomenon I had never seen before. The sun, which was fairly high, looked like a pale yellow opaque globe completely surrounded by a luminous halo, which nevertheless did not prevent me at all from staring attentively at the sun without the slightest discomfort. A very light cloud was before it. The opaque globe began moving outwards, slowly turning over upon itself, and going from left to right and vice versa. but within the globe very strong movements could be seen in all clarity and without interruption. The same phenomenon repeated itself on the following day, October 31. The solemnities of the definition of the Assumption. On this vigil of All Saints' Day, which was also the vigil of the long-awaited day, a great popular procession had triumphantly carried the venerable image of the Madonna, called Salus Populi Romani, from Araceli to St. Peter's Square. Sister Pasqualina reports in her memoirs that after returning from his walk on October 30, the Holy Father immediately described the superb spectacle he had just witnessed. She then went through the account, almost identical to the one we have just read, but she adds a very interesting unpublished testimony. The following day was a Sunday. Full of hope, we too went to the gardens in the hope of seeing this spectacle too, but we came back disappointed. The Holy Father immediately asked, "Did you see it? Today it was exactly like yesterday." On the following day, November 1, at 6 o'clock in the morning, a compact crowd pressed into the doors of the Vatican Basilica. Before long, at St. Peter's Square, the Via della Conciliazione and the banks of the Tiber surrounding it were occupied by the multitude of 600,000 to 700,000 pilgrims. Sister Pasqualina recalls that the weather was splendid. Was it a May day breaking, so pure and serene, or was it really November 1? A silent joy broke out in the soul, Ave Maria. At 8:30, the Sistine choirs intoned the Litany of the Saints, while the long pontifical procession of 36 cardinals and over 600 bishops entered St. Peter's Square through the bronze doors. The spectacular ceremony began on the square in front of the basilica. In the name of the entire church, the Cardinal Dean addressed the Sovereign Pontiff, asking for the dogmatic definition. The Pope responded, and after the chant of the Veni Creator pronounced the infallible words, proclaiming and defining that it is a dogma divinely revealed that Mary, the Immaculate and Ever-Virgin Mother of God, at the end of her earthly life, was assumed body and soul into heavenly glory. The crowd immediately broke out into endless applause, while Cardinal Tisserand thanked the Holy Father and asked him to order the publication of the dogmatic bull. The Pope then intoned the Te Deum. He then spoke a brief allocution to the faithful, which he ended by reciting on his knees a prayer to the Virgin of the Assumption. Here once more is Sister Pasqualina's account. A deep blue sky extended above the cupola of St. Peter's. Beside the sun one could also see the crescent of the moon, just above the cross of the cupola. How was this possible? The others saw it and were astonished. Who is this, fair as the moon, beautiful as the sun, we recite on prime of that day? Already it was most extraordinary that the day was so warm and so clear, and this crescent of the moon over the cupola of Michelangelo at this hour of the feast created the effect of a wonderful symbol. After the solemn apostolic benediction given to the crowd by the Sovereign Pontiff, the ceremony continued in St. Peter's Basilica by the chanting of Nun and the Papal Mass, where for the first time was chanted the admirable office opening with the words of the Seer of Patmos, Signum Magnum Apparut in Scylla, Mulier Amicta Sol et Luna sub Pedibus Eius. A great sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, and the moon beneath her feet. APOC 12:1. On the afternoon of this memorable day, which was the crowning and apogee of the holy year and even the entire pontificate, the Holy Father once again took his usual walk in the Vatican Gardens. Here is the end of the account, where he reports his vision of the dance of the sun. The same phenomenon took place the following day, October 31, and on November 1, the day of the definition, and then on November 8, the octave day of the same solemnity. Since then, nothing more. Several times, on other days at the same hour and in identical or very similar atmospheric conditions, I tried to look at the sun to see if the same phenomenon would appear to me, but in vain, I could not stare at the sun for an instant as my vision was immediately blinded. Such is the pure truth, in brief and simple terms. Sister Pasqualina also recalls. The Holy Father saw this prodigy again on the day of the proclamation of the dogma and one more time on the octave of the feast. We would have loved to see it ourselves, but that was not granted us. Pius XII had some inquiries made with Specula, the director of the Vatican Observatory, but there, too, nobody knew anything and nobody had seen anything. Other inquiries made with outside sources at the Holy Father's request also had no results. Thus Pius XII was the only witness of this prodigy. For this reason it is not possible to impose it on the consideration of the savants as an indisputable historical fact, like the solar miracle of October 13, 1917, observed by over 70,000 pilgrims and curious souls, all unanimous in their testimony. Pius XII's account is of a different order. Still, we are convinced of the authenticity of the facts, both because of the intrinsic solidity of the testimony as well as the august quality of the witness. For how, especially, if one is a Catholic, can we place in doubt such testimony furnished by the Holy Father himself, with this precision, this assurance, and this solemnity? Thus we are convinced that on four occasions Pope Pius XII saw a wonderful phenomenon which renewed the miracle of the Coveta Iria before his eyes. Now the question arises, what was the meaning, what was the significance of this authentic intervention from heaven in the Sovereign Pontiff's life? The sign of the Virgin of the Assumption. First of all, as Cardinal Tedeschini later said, no doubt echoing what the Pope had confided to him, it cannot be denied that this wonderful vision was a reward for the Pope, a sign showing that the definition of the dogma of the Assumption was supremely pleasing to God. The coincidence of this extraordinary phenomenon with the infallible proclamation of the dogma highlights this point in all clarity. For the Pope had contemplated the dance of the sun on October 30th, the date of the official announcement of the definition, on October 31st and November 1st, the vigil and very day of the proclamation, and finally on November 8th, the octave day of the solemnity. We recall that already on December 8, 1854, during the definition of the dogma of the Immaculate Conception by Venerable Pope Pius IX, let it be said in passing that Pius XII ordered the work for his beatification resumed, heaven had manifested itself to the Sovereign Pontiff. At the moment of pronouncing the infallible words, Pius IX had felt that suddenly his voice was mysteriously strengthened and amplified, to the point of resounding throughout the basilica. At the same instant, although it had been raining heavily up till then, precisely at the moment when the pontiff pronounced the words of the definition, heaven opened and a ray of light came to illuminate the pontiff. Finally, were not the apparitions of lords themselves the divine recompense granted to the Church by the Immaculate Virgin, in response to her glorification by the Sovereign Pontiff? Saint Bernadette took it this way, writing to Venerable Pope Pius IX, "How good is Our Lady! One could say that she came to confirm the words of our Holy Father." Was not the vision of the dance of the sun for Pius XII the comparable heavenly confirmation of the dogma of the Assumption? No doubt it occurred to him, when in his encyclical Fulgens Corona he repeated the same expression as the Seer of Lourdes, "It appears that the Blessed Virgin willed in some way to confirm by a prodigy the sentence which the Vicar of her Divine Son had pronounced." The sign of Our Lady of Fatima. Besides being a heavenly confirmation of the dogma of the Assumption, the vision of the dance of the sun also had a more precise and pressing significance. It was the miracle of 1917 which was renewed 33 years later, before the eyes of the Holy Father at the Vatican. This grace, Cardinal Tedeschini later said, was a heavenly testimony destined to authenticate the connection of the marvels of Fatima with the center, the leader of the truth and the Catholic magisterium. Yes, it was Our Lady of Fatima who, no doubt in answer to her messenger's humble supplications, gave the Holy Father direct, spectacular proof of the reality of the apparitions and the urgency of her message. The time for doubting Fatima is past. The hour for action has arrived, the Pope had declared a few months earlier. Our Lady of Fatima came to encourage him to walk resolutely along this road. The sign she gave him was the most pressing invitation to give his assent to her message, without any more reservations or hesitations. It was also a very clear indication that the hour had come to finally carry out all her requests. The sign of the Virgin most powerful. This dance of the sun manifested the all-powerful mediation of Our Lady, Pulchra ut Luna, Electa ut Sol, Terribilis ut Castrorum Aces Ordinata, fair as the moon, bright as the sun, terrible as an army set in battle array. It was undoubtedly the promise of a very special protection for the Holy Father, and the extraordinary help of the Queen of Heaven in all his battles. It was the pledge of victory. After the publication of Humani Generis against all the modern errors, after the firm decision taken by the Pope to conclude the canonization process of Pius X in spite of all opposition, after the solemn exercise of his infallibility in proclaiming the dogma of the Assumption, did not Heaven want to encourage the Pope to continue in this sense without fearing anything or anyone any longer? Indeed, this striking sign appearing in the heavens was at once the richest of rewards, the most pressing encouragement, the most wonderful promise and the announcement of final victory. The preparations for the council were continuing. Was this not the occasion to announce its upcoming convocation to the hundreds of bishops gathering in Rome? Surely, in the atmosphere of intense Marian devotion then reigning, the Portuguese bishops would not have failed to make petitions. These petitions would have encountered the vastest of audiences in the bishops of the world, and Our Lady of Fatima's requests finally could have been accomplished by a unanimous council. Unfortunately, perhaps through excessive prudence and distrust of himself, Pius XII did no such thing. He preferred to wait. On November 23 and December 10, he made two brief allusions to Fatima, and that was all. Yet the hour was grave. The question of the ecumenical council, the decisive confrontation. At the end of the Holy Year and the beginning of 1951, the question of the council was becoming urgent. Was the preparatory work going to continue or would it be interrupted? The hour had come when the Pope had to decide between publicly announcing the upcoming meeting of the Council, the 1500th anniversary of the Council of Chalcedon presented a happy coincidence, or abandoning the project for good. The maneuvering and odious blackmail of the innovators. On January 4, 1951, during a meeting of the Preparatory Commission, Father Charles, the Secretary General, made this strange declaration under the guise of giving a rundown of the work completed at the Holy Office. The task of our commission is to prepare the matter which can be submitted to the future Ecumenical Council, which we have already done to a great extent, perhaps superabundantly. The subjects which have been proposed concerning the errors to be condemned, the tightening and adaptation of discipline, the foreign missions, the meaning and the value of sacred scripture, the protection and inculcation of moral precepts in effect surpass by their number and their importance what can be handled by just one council. Astonishing! After 3 years of work ordinarily done under his control, the Secretary General suddenly believed that the matter prepared was too vast and that this would compromise the very possibility of the council. What was actually going on? Father Capril tells us enough to give us a very clear picture. The Secretary General and a minority of Commission members wanted, at all costs, to prevent the Council from solemnly condemning all the modern errors denounced by Pius XII in Humani Generis. These people, who secretly belonged to the progressive and semi-modernist party, or at least wanted to protect it, put forward all sorts of specious reasoning to get Pius XII to decide to abandon the project. They pretended to desire a brief council, to avoid the disadvantages of a prolonged absence of the bishops from their dioceses, and the problems which would be caused by 3,000 bishops staying in Rome with their theologians. They also believed that the council ought to give the world a solemn testimony of unity and unanimity. These, of course, were only vain pretexts, which the innovators used to justify presenting a counter-project. In fact, they desired a completely different council than the one Cardinal Ruffini had been inspired to suggest, that Pius XII had decided to call, and that the Holy Office had docilely and actively prepared with Monsignor Ottaviani, Archbishop Borgognini Duca, and Monsignor Tardini. They were already dreaming of something else. As Archbishop Borgognini Duca remarks in his final report, according to those who were of this tendency, the council could have for its principal purpose, not the handling of the Church's internal affairs, in other words, to condemn with precision and firmness the heresies developing there since 1944, for which the encyclicals, constitutions, codes, etc. published by the Apostolic See sufficed, which is false. In moments of grave crisis, general councils always proved to be extremely useful and even indispensable, but to recall to Peter's fold the dissidents and infidels of the whole world, this was making the ecumenical attraction, the natural fruit of a fully successful dogmatic and disciplinary council, the primary purpose of the council, which would tend to exclude others. In this case, the assembly of bishops would have to take on particular characteristics. In short, they above all did not want an infallible council which would pronounce anathemas, and raise up a new syllabus of modern errors. So Father Charles proposed a new kind of council which would follow a completely original procedure, to reach the desired results. The commission, he suggested, would have to write up a brief and complete text which would present clearly and in a positive manner the principal truths professed by the Church and considered particularly important for today's world. This text should not enter into any controversy, so as to be unanimously acceptable by the Council, even by acclamation. In fact, the 10-point project proposed by Father Charles in the beginning of January 1951, under the title Authentic Declaration on the Ecumenical Council, was deliberately vague and absolutely foreign to the dogmatic spirit in which the work had been proceeding until then. Infallibility had been removed in favor of a simple authentic declaration, which left complete liberty to leave the area of revealed truth, and speak of something else. We find there a condemnation of all discrimination based on color, race, or nationality, a confirmation of the dignity of woman and her equal rights with men, an affirmation of the dignity of work and workers. There is a reminder of the common missionary responsibility of pastors and the faithful. On certain points that it brings up, this document is a prelude to what later became the Constitution on the Church in the Modern World of Vatican Council II. All in all, it was already the spirit of Pacem in Terris and the famous Schema 13. However, the innovators pretended not to rule out the idea of pronouncing condemnations. With consummate skill, Father Charles simply proposed that they be put off for later on, in other words, after the council. Before disbanding, the council would merely indicate its opinion on these questions, but decide nothing. Especially nothing infallible. Father Caprell continues. At the same time, but separately, the fathers could have been presented a list of errors to be condemned and reforms to be instituted, leaving in this area also wide opportunities and a great liberty to propose amendments, additions, suggestions, etc. Once the council ended, the decrees on these matters could have been prepared by the departments of the Roman Curia, with the help of commissions and in the spirit of the council, a council deliberately and necessarily unanimous, ecumenical and irenical, as we have seen. And so, there you had it. Rome would go no further than Humani Generis, for the pontifical documents published by the departments of the Curia would have no greater authority than an encyclical from the Pope. Father Charles went on to lay heavy stress on the one and only advantage of this revolutionary solution. According to this procedure, he affirmed, the council could last no more than 3 or 4 weeks at the most. It could be completed before Easter, 1951. For this reason, Father Charles wrote, I humbly suggest that this procedure be submitted to the Sovereign Pontiff, who with authority and prudence will decide if we can continue our work and bring it to a happy and prompt conclusion. If not, I strongly fear that the immense material that we have prepared may prove to be unsuitable for the conciliar form. In other words, the Secretary General was throwing all his moral authority behind this innovative solution. He went further, and let the Pope know clearly that for him and his friends, it was this or nothing. Pius XII would find himself forced to choose between this stupid, unacceptable project, and the pure and simple abandonment of the project of the Council. What good was it to have 3,000 bishops come to Rome to vote by acclamation for a hollow, fine-sounding discourse intended to please the world, but without any authority or effective doctrinal content for the defense of the Church's faith? Father Charles and his accomplices were engaging in odious blackmail. In opposition to them, the President, Archbishop Borgognini Duca, Monsignor Ottaviani, Monsignor Tardini and the majority of the commission members wanted a real council, which would have examined and infallibly settled real questions. They had worked for it, they saw its importance and they ardently desired it to become a reality. After explaining the counter-project of the innovators, Father Caprile makes an admission. But others, who were more numerous than the first group, thought differently within the commission. According to them, the council had to follow the traditional method, in other words it would first of all require a long period of preparation. Only when this period had been completed would it be possible to consider setting a date for the council. As for the duration of the council, no limits could be imposed on it. The fathers had to be left in complete liberty, and at all costs they should not be given the impression that everything had been settled beforehand by the Roman Curia. What must be said is that if Father Charles had organized and encouraged all the preparatory work, as he should have done, instead of creating obstacles, and elaborating, with a few accomplices, a project for a new kind of council, the preparatory work could have been terminated in 1951-1952. At this period, the most traditional procedure would rapidly have resulted in a striking unanimity for the texts prepared by the Holy Office, in the spirit of Pius XII. Because it feared this certain success, the tiny minority of the progressive clan attempted, by the most tortuous methods, to undermine this great ecumenical council, which would have brought about the downfall of the progressives. In early January 1951, Father Charles and his friends decided to give Pius XII the brutal presentation of the grave opposition now dividing the preparatory commission into two antagonistic parts, to the point where work was practically paralyzed. As everyone saw, Father Caprile writes, the divergences within the commission went much further than questions of organization. Since they resulted from a different manner of conceiving the meeting of the council, their incidences made themselves felt on all the work immediately at hand, its scope, its duration, the form of documents to be prepared. During the last meeting on January 4, 1951, it was decided to put the question before the Holy Father, who ordered no more work to be done on the project. This decision put an end to an immense hope. We know that after 3 years of work, Pius XII resigned himself to calling off the council only with great regret. Why then did he make this decision? On this point Father Caprile cites the testimony of Father Giacomo Martgani, S.J., who as director of Civiltà Cattolica from 1939 to 1955 was received by the Pope in audience every 15 days. I well remember, he declares, that Pius XII ended by giving up this idea against his better judgment, for two fundamental reasons which he repeated several times: one, his already advanced age; two, his physical strength was too weak to attend to his ordinary work, which was always overwhelming. This will be for my successor, he concluded. We have an identical testimony from another source. A group of Italian bishops recommended the usefulness of a council, and several times Pius XII answered them, it's true, but I am too old, it will be my successor who does it. I am too old. It is true that at the beginning of 1951 Pius XII was pushing 75. But he was not afflicted with any grave illness, and he could reasonably hope to enjoy sufficient health for several more years. Granted, the holy year had been trying, but it had also been a time of grace and abundant activity. Sister Pasqualina attests to it. When the holy year began, on December 24, 1949, Pius XII had been governing the Church of God for over 10 years. He was still fresh, alert, and almost like a young man in spite of his 73 years. With all his soul and with indefatigable zeal, he devoted himself to all those who desired to take advantage of the benefits of the holy year, those who desired to see him and receive his blessing. In fact, by putting forward his advanced age, Pius XII was no doubt giving a pretext which was not decisive, for he could not have forgotten to take this into account 3 years earlier, when he had given the order to begin the council's preparation. If he really considered himself too old, he never would have made this decision. Clearly, the unforeseen difficulties which came up during the preparation made him think twice. If the preparatory commission had accomplished its work with diligence and enthusiasm, and in unanimity, it is very probable that Pius XII would have persevered in his design. But the counter-project put forward by Father Charles brought before his eyes such grave and profound divisions among the commission members that the Pope would be forced to re-examine the whole work himself. This would lead him to make painful decisions, which he was not used to resolving himself to do. In effect, how could the Pope get out of this impasse, except by openly disavowing the man he had chosen 3 years earlier as his trusted aide, confiding to him the role of secretary of the Central Commission? Yes, it was necessary to make a choice between the two parties before everyone, resolutely removing those who had created obstacles to the progress of the work. But this minority enjoyed powerful protectors, some of whom were undoubtedly among the Pope's most intimate collaborators. To unmask their hypocritical and perfidious maneuvers and continue, with that much more firmness, his great design by assembling the already planned and prepared council without delay, the Pope would have had to act with heroic courage. He would have needed an increase of supernatural light and strength. Without any doubt, Our Lady of Fatima would have granted them to him abundantly, if in all humility and trust he had resolutely committed himself to the path she had marked out for him, graciously permitting him to contemplate the great miracle of the Son at the Vatican. But Pius XII had hesitated, procrastinated. And a few months later, a coup de majeste became necessary to ward off the ambushes of the council's adversaries. The Pope backed off. Today we can see it better, this abandoning of the project of the council by Pius XII, finally giving way before the tenacious opposition of a handful of innovators, was going to have the most fatal consequences for the preservation of the faith in the Church. The clan of liberals, progressives, or semi-modernists had just come away with its first victory. It was a sizable one, and it had great consequences. The great hope of the pontificate was extinguished, and at the same time, the most favorable opportunity for the implementation of the Fatima message. After this crucial year, 1950, the decline was going to begin. To be sure, the final years of Pius XII's reign, like those of King Louis XIV after 1689, the parallel is striking. Were still glorious years, and ever so fruitful for the Church. They still shine brightly with the splendor of the peak years. But they are already tragically clouded by shady maneuvers of the unvanquished adversary, giving reason to fear frightful storms. Pope Pius XII welcomes the Pilgrim Virgin of Fatima in St. Peter's Basilica.